Elvis Presley was for many more than a cultural phenomenon. He was a god. He was literally worshipped by thousands, described by one of his fans as the greatest king to ever walk the earth, unquote. Now, I've always been very hard-pressed to understand how this country boy was transformed into this monumental idol. Even after the peak of his popularity in his 40s, complete with bulging stomach and bags under his eyes, he drew crowds of thousands, yay, millions, via television. When Elvis moved his pelvis, he moved the masses. I ain't nothing but a hound dog. Hey, sing it, baby. We're all hound dogs, sniffing out pleasure, looking for meat, howling in pain, and chewing on old bones. When the lights flash and the drums beat and the hips move, we feel ourselves coming alive. Sing on and let the movement of your pelvis hypnotize us into daring to admit that, in fact, friends, we are flesh. After all, the body was designed to move. But what really shocked the pietists was that Elvis performed his gyrations and then, without any shame, switched into "How Great Thou Art," closed his eyes as though in prayer, and held his masses in the palm of his hands. The scandal came in linking sexuality with spirituality. Without shame, he acknowledged the animal within us while pointing to the dimension beyond. We are creatures made to be at home on the earth, and yet we have a consciousness that raises us to something more. Perhaps that's why Elvis was seen as being one of the greatest, because he brought us back to our senses. He became a symbol that combined body and soul into self as a model of what it is to be fully, unashamedly human, without any kind of phony dualism. And what is it, in fact, that the Christian community gathers around? The body. This is my body. Take, eat. This is my blood, shed for you. The Eucharist is an extremely sensual celebration of life. Talk about the feast of life. Christians gather around the body. It is a reminder that God became flesh and dwells in the midst of us, and that the flesh moves, celebrates, interacts, is alive. And exciting. I don't remember who said it, but there's this great quote: God saved the world, we are called to savor it. Unfortunately, the image that is more often associated with the church is the one described in East of Eden by John Steinbeck. Quote, he brought with him his tiny Irish wife, a tight, hard little woman, humorless as a chicken. She had a dour Presbyterian mind and a code of morals that pinned down and beat the brains out of nearly everything that was pleasant to do. Unquote. I was riding the bus in Milwaukee one day, and there were two black women who were sitting right behind me. It was very hard not to overhear the conversation. Besides, I get my best sermon material on the public bus. And the one said to the other, she says, you remember that white lady bought that house up there in the corner? And the other one says, yeah, I remember that one got the dog. Yeah, that's the one. The one scared of us sneakers got that great big dog going to protect her. Yeah, I remember you telling about her. What about her? Well, us niggers she was so scared of, we started noticing the lights weren't going on over there. Pretty soon the papers started piling up. So we called the police. We was watching, and they came, and they went up in the porch there, and they banged on the door, and they walked around the house. Nothing. Shades pulled, door locked. Well, the old lady was in there, that was for sure. So finally, we was watching. They went and they got a great big thing and they rammed that door open. You know what they found? First they found her arm, then they found her leg. Blood all over the place. That damn dog done chewed her up. I thought that was marvelous. I mean, not that the old lady got chewed up.
Are they glorifying in that?
No, they were not. It was just a report of what had happened to the old lady in the White House. No, I think they sensed an irony, a tragedy. But it occurs to me that often we, like the old woman, fail to see the animal that is locked up inside of our own household. The hound dog, just like the woman, needed to be free. I ain't nothing but a hound dog. Hey, singing, honey. We're all hound dogs, sniffing out pleasure, looking for meat, howling in pain, and chewing on old bones. Oh, that we could be called out of our dark cages and walked in the light and called by name and integrated into whole, healthy people, human beings. Yeah, God saved the world, and we are called to savor it. It is in the repression and the denial of our instincts that we become estranged from our own realities. We begin to fantasize that all the beasts are out there in the streets. They're all in the porny shows and on the newsstands. That's where they all are. In the massage parlors. When in fact, in trying to pray ourselves up to the realm of the spirit, as though we could separate ourselves from the realities of our own body, we lose sight of our intrinsic nature, and we often become then destroyed from within. It's not the porny shops, it's not the massage parlors. It's that which is within us that begins to chew us up. We target the wrong enemies. I think some of the fundamentalists are the very groups that keep the porny shops going, to tell you the truth. And what is it that we mean when we say they're living in sin? Well, what does that usually mean? Sin usually is equated with sex, right? Right. Dorothy Sayers once said, "Perhaps the bitterest commentary on the way in which Christian doctrine has been taught in the last few centuries is the fact that to the majority of people, the word immorality has come to mean one thing and one thing only. A person may be greedy and selfish, spiteful, cruel, jealous, unjust, violent, brutal, dead to every noble instinct, and still we are not ready to say of him or of her that they are not moral." Sarah Miles, in commenting on a film she appeared in called Lady Carolyn Lamb, said, "I'm amused that someone thinks that a glimpse of my nipples could corrupt the youth of America. When I read statistics like one in every five people in America is either burgled or mugged, I wonder whether a glimpse of nipple now and then might not help." Along the same line, we hear the thoughts of Herbert Marcuse, who, in an essay called An Essay on Liberation, says, "Obscene is not the picture of a naked woman who exposes her pubic hair, but that of a fully clad general who exposes his medals rewarded in a war of aggression. Obscene is not the ritual of hippies, but the declaration of a high dignitary of the church that war is necessary for peace. That is obscene." When is it that we come to define living in sin in such a very restrictive and very narrow manner? Why is it that very often obedience to the authority of parents or the church is replaced by a dogmatic ideal that equates sexual expertise with freedom? On the other hand, the church separates the body from the self and assumes that through discipline, denial, and ignorance, the body can be ignored without damage to the self. An old kind of dualism, which suggests that the body is simply a shell of flesh from which we will escape at the time of death, which, by the way, is not a Christian concept. However, the new authorities seem to offer another distortion, a moral code that treats sex as a function of the body, an appetite or an instinct that must be satisfied. Sex then becomes a purely physical activity without any involvement of the self. Either of these attitudes fails to respect or recognize the inner relationship of body and self and distorts the balance needed for whole, mature, healthy integration of personality. And both of these are very destructive for freedom. Looking first at the more Victorian model, we encounter such goodies as this. There was a young lady named Wilde who kept herself quite undefiled by thinking of Jesus and social diseases and the fear of having a child. St. Augustine was responsible for much of the church's fear of sex and women. He taught that all sexual pleasure was sinful, even when enjoyed in marriage and in the course of reproductive activity. Though the sacrament of marriage ensured its forgiveness, provided that the Christian did not positively desire the pleasure. It is characteristic of a good Christian, he wrote, to love in a woman the creature of God whom he desires to be transformed and renewed, but to hate corruptible and mortal intimacy and sexual intercourse. That is, to love the human being in her, but to hate what belongs to her as a wife. The medieval elevation of permanent chastity as a good in itself and a requirement for the priesthood, as distinct from a special vocation, was a significant indication of the devaluation of sexuality. The early church thought original sin was transmitted through sexual intercourse. Women even today feel these traces of the Eve or the Mary images. Eve heard the word and disobeyed. With cunning, she seduced Adam into the fall. Now, traditionally then, women have been seen as manipulating men through the power of their sexuality, since they can't get power any other way. You know, the old whisper in the pillow after the council meeting thing. Mary, on the other hand, was seen as undefiled. Conception of Jesus came from the Holy Spirit. The Mother of God was pure and had transcended her physicality. Since sin came through intercourse, Jesus was without sin, because Mary never had intercourse, right? So a high Marialetry developed. And women chose the celibate life, for it was thought to be a religious calling. There also was a certain mystification about female biology. Men would look at a woman and say, now how can that be? She bleeds every month for how many days, and she doesn't die. Now, if I bled for 4 days every month, I'd be a goner. What is this about her? There's something very mysterious about this. And what's more, this issue of blood was life-giving. There was some kind of power that the woman had for recreating or for creating life, which was unavailable to the male. And so it became something that was very fearful. And in order to manage this and cope with it, women were relegated as being less than males, you see. Strange, isn't it? Subservient to their lord and their master. And this issuance of blood was regarded as being unclean instead of life-giving. Would that we could say that that practice has been totally lost. In a recent book by a woman named Judith M. Miles called The Feminine Principle, A Woman's Discovery of the Key to Total Fulfillment, we read, "One day this familiar verse acquired a heightened meaning for me. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord." Ephesians 5:22. It could not mean that. Not as to the Lord. But there it was. I was to treat my own husband as though he were the Lord, resident in our own humble home. This was truly revelatory to me. Would I ask Jesus a basically maternal question such as, "How are things at the office?" Would I suggest to Jesus that he finish some task around the house? Would I remind the Lord that he was not driving prudently? Would I ever be in judgment over my Lord, over his tastes, his opinions, or his actions? I was stunned. Stunned into a new kind of submission. Herbert Marcuse introduces another closely knit system that undergirds this kind of devotion and enslavement. In Eros and Civilization, he writes that capitalist society has brought about a surplus repression of sexuality in the service of the performance principle, which allows a particular group to dominate and sustain itself in a privileged position of power and wealth. Our culture, in order to keep the masses in subjection, puts an unnecessarily rigid taboo on bodily pleasure and limits acceptable sexuality to genital activity linked with procreation. Any enjoyment of sex as an end in itself is seen as a threat to order and authority, a diversion from the work ethic which demands man's energies in the service of production and aggression. Religion contributes by its sex-denying ideals, enforced by feelings of guilt, and by offering future happiness in return for sexual restraint in this world. The body becomes a productive tool of labor rather than an instrument of pleasure. It's a very interesting idea, isn't it? That, again, that the body is simply an extension of production. So then, women have been stereotyped as temptresses, sex objects, who are manipulative, who lure men into disobedience by virtue of their physicality, or as mother figures who are to be placed on a pedestal and held in reverence. Both are very dehumanizing. As dehumanizing as the portrayal of woman being created to serve men. Theologically, none of these reflect the truth. In the beginning, God created male and female. We were called good and made in God's image. When the incident of disobedience occurred, human beings were not only separated from their Creator, but from each other. All of a sudden, We were reaching for fig leaves, feeling ashamed, and seeing ourselves as different. Men were put in a one-up position, and harmony was destroyed. This was one of the major functions of the Christ event: to restore that which had been broken, to open communication between God and the creatures, but also between the creatures themselves, to call out our gifts and to help us rediscover our freedom to be actualized as God meant for us to be. That which was created in juxtaposition fell. The coming of Christ was a call for us once again to regain relationship and wholeness, male and female, as those who are human, those given power to name our world, and to come together in celebration with joy. Masters and Johnson, however, in reporting on the influence of this, of a kind of channel visioned religious orthodoxy, that which would bind rather than free, have found that in adolescence it is a major cause of sexual inadequacy and dysfunction in marriage. Pain in intercourse, premature ejaculation, and impotence are often traceable to an anti-sexual religious upbringing. Prudence Tunadine, a Christian psychiatrist, wrote, "Many who fear intercourse or who cannot respond emotionally hide their fears behind rationalization of morality. They unconsciously take into themselves parental or religious prohibitions which are in conflict with their sexual desires and which are ridden with anxiety or guilt. The marriage ceremony does not, alas, alter this unconscious conflict," unquote. This neurosis, as William Kroger labeled it, certainly curtails and distorts full celebrative participation in sexual relationships. But evidence would show that there is no more personal freedom in the counter movement, which advocates sex for sex's sake. Bouncing out of one bed and into another does not have the liberating effect on personhood that it is advertised to have either. Defining promiscuity in this way, Willis Stanley says, "Promiscuity is the indiscriminate, compulsive seeking of a series of transient sexual encounters based neither on love nor on friendship, but merely on the relief of sexual tensions in which little or no significance is attached to the non-sexual attributes of the partners. This kind of recreational, tension-relieving sex play becomes tinged with frustration, loneliness, and quiet desperation because of a paucity of communication and commitment," according to Rollo May in his book Love and Will. He also says, "Sexual love can not only be play, but probably an element of all sexual love should be sheer play. But if one's whole pattern and attitude toward sex is only casual, then sooner or later the playing itself becomes boring. The same is true of sensuality, obviously an element in any gratifying sexual love. If it has to carry the whole weight of the relationship, it becomes cloying. If sex is only sensuality, you sooner or later turn against sex itself," unquote. Germaine Greer uses the phrase rape by fraud, a phony tenderness or false promise of an enduring relationship corrodes a woman's self-esteem so that she grows by degrees not to care too much what happens or how. The results of this hardening of the heart are eventually much worse than the consequences of fortuitous sexual assault by a stranger. The more so because they are internalized, insidious, and imperceptible. Even to say, "I love you," or "Do you love me?" when you know there is no real affection present, is a dishonest play on emotions. There are those who believe that there is no such thing as casual encounter in intercourse. Derek Bailey in The Mystery of Love and Marriage writes, "Intercourse is a personal encounter between man and woman in which each does something to the other for good or for ill, which can never be obliterated. When a couple have coitus together, other than in cases of rape or the seduction of the young or feeble-minded, Bailey believes that they truly become one flesh, whether they realize it or not. However much their future actions may deny it, this union remains a profoundly significant reality which affects their very being. If they are married, it provides the basis for ever-deepening community between them. If they are not, they merely enact a hollow, ephemeral, diabolical parody of marriage which works disintegration in the personality and leaves behind a deep-seated sense of frustration and dissatisfaction, though this may never be brought to the surface of consciousness and may never be fully realized. One of the fruits of this kind of alienating experience is a breakdown in trust between sexes. Kate Millett calls marriage civil death, domestic slavery, an oppressive instrument of male supremacy, and a tool of the state frustrating revolutionary change. Janice Kelly has stated flatly that a woman would be foolish to be entirely open and trusting with a member of the class whose very status is founded on her debasement, unquote. This is quite the other extreme from the woman who is calling her husband Lord. It illustrates, I think, an almost schizoid mind in this culture with relationship to sexuality. Is it any wonder that those of us who are pastors or who work in the counseling field are faced very often with people sitting in our offices in a state of confusion and anger and hurt and rejection, some reaching toward authority, wanting someone to make it straight for them again, to give them rules, to give them signposts, some coming from honest needs to be relieved of guilt, which has been planted and which has arisen from having transgressed against deeply rooted moral and religious beliefs. Is it any wonder in this kind of schizoid situation that we are faced with in our culture that sexuality becomes a major issue and becomes very disorienting in terms of personal direction and value? What matters is that the person learns to act and think sexually without evasion, deceit, or illusion, that he or she can distinguish the false myths of the old and of the countercultures from the truth, and above all, that there is growth in the capacity for self-giving and sympathy and caring. It is helpful in working with those of a Christian faith to point again to the model of Christ. If they think in biblical quotes, it is good to replace the Pauline texts, which are enunciated, by the way, within a very narrow cultural context, with those of the Christ. For example, when a woman is caught in adultery and about to be stoned, the Pharisees and scribes come to Jesus and attempt to trip him up. And what does he say? Let him who is without sin among you cast the first stone. And what did they do? They went away. And when Jesus looked up and he saw that he was left alone with this woman, he said, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and do not sin again." She has been confronted. She has been accused. She has been publicly humiliated. And Jesus is saying, but this is not something one does alone. A woman does not commit adultery by herself. And further, this is not a crime that is punishable by death. But basically, it is a matter of men and their double standard of morality. It takes two to commit adultery. And Jesus sees her as a person, not a public lesson. He moves with compassion. She deserved full process, not automatic accusation and rejection. And so she is set free. In Luke 11:27-28, a woman in the crowd raised her voice and said to Jesus, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that you sucked." And what does he say? No. Blessed, rather, are those who hear the word of God and keep it. And yet, what have women always heard? In the Leah-Rachel account in the Old Testament, where to be barren is to be damned. Salvation is to conceive, to please your husband, to bear his seed. What about women who can't bear his seed? What about women who don't have children? Are they any less whole? Are they any less women? Are they any less significant in the kingdom? Or is their whole definition that of biological function? Jesus says no. It's not that Mary had me in her womb and bore me. It was that she was obedient to God. And again, in New Testament times, the highest of image of woman is Mary, right? We look to Mary, the mother. And the most virtuous role that is presented to the woman is that of motherhood. This is something, fortunately, I think that we in the 20th century have begun to re-examine. Jesus is making a revolutionary statement here about human beings. We as women are not valued in terms of our reproductive function. A woman as well as a man can hear the word of God and do it. And finally, I should like to point out that confession, absolution, compassion are all very strong words in our vocabulary. But they are more than words. They are power. And they are part of what we understand in sexual relationship with one another. It's a waste of good life to be paralyzed in guilt, to be immobilized, so immersed in our own regret, in our own self-rejection, that we are locked in place and unable to move forward in new relationship. Many times, people need forgiveness. To truly know that, they have to go back into the depths of their religious tradition, not in its rigid, binding, judgmental form, but in its freeing, opening, human capacity to say, go, as Jesus said to the woman in adultery, go and sin no more. I give you life. Your sexual involvements, one with the other, your mistakes, your regrets, your failures are real. They are part of who you are. They are your story. But if the gospel is to have any significance for you, then go and sin no more, if that is the way you want to look at it. because sin is to be immobilized in grief and guilt and unable then to take up your life and move on with trust and wholeness, to be fully human, to be a sexual creature, alive, sensual, vibrant, good as I made you to be. When you go up to the communion rail and you take the bread and the wine, and the pastor says, because you have given authority, not because the pastor has the authority, but because the church has given the authority through the Spirit to say, your sins are forgiven you. I declare unto you the full forgiveness of all your sins, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Go. I give you life. Turn around. Go from the altar. Move back. Celebrate your body and your soul and your wholeness. Be in relationship and be free. Christians never quite get the point, do they? They never quite get it. We are not people who act sexually. We are sexual. I'm not trapped in this body. This is me. My name's June. Okay? This is me. You can pinch me, trip me, hold me, kiss me, hug me. This is me. Here. This is what I present to you. Body, mind, soul, intelligence, all of me. And therefore, when I give myself to you in trust, you hold my life in your arms. That's me. Love is the active concern for the life and growth of that which we love, a concern that finds expression in caring, responsibility, respect, true knowledge of the other. That's what's all part and parcel of being sexual human beings. Now, there's a lot of stuff there to unpack, isn't there? Who wants to start unpacking? Yes.
If we are in fact sexual beings, then what do we do with the people from their birth who feel homosexual rather than heterosexual? How do we handle that? How does the church deal with that?
How did Jesus deal with those things? He took people where they were. He treated them seriously. He respected their story. He didn't judge them. He didn't lay on prerequisites. When the woman at the well came, he didn't say, you're a dirty prostitute, you're a village tramp. I wouldn't speak to you in the middle of noon. Out here in broad daylight, a Jewish man talking to a Samaritan woman, drinking out of the same cup? No. He met her where she was. He listened to her and he revealed to her who he was. And she turned around and had a word to speak and went back to the village. That happened consistently. Jesus took people where they came to him. If they sat down and they were in anguish or suffering or were having something they needed to share, he treated them where they came to him with some sense of authenticity and respect. We don't know enough about homosexuality. I never judge a homosexual that comes into my office. I say, brother, sit down. Why do you want to talk to me? What's going on in your life today? Where are you? Where's your struggle? What are you contending with? And sometimes the story I hear is kind of shocking to me. It's not in my experience. It's not my element of sexual activity. But for some reason, this brother has come and has sought someone with whom he can share his experience in his life and his suffering. And I'm called not to judge him or reject him, but to hear him and to be with him as he struggles to find out who he is. That's how I handle it.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a comment. I don't have a question, just a comment for what it's worth, because it's germane to what you said earlier. 38 years ago, as part of the military, I spent some time with the Eskimos in Greenland. And it is true, at that time it was true. I don't think it is now. I don't have facts to back me up one way or another. But during the menstrual cycle, the woman did live outside the home. The Danish government tried to move against that practice, but couldn't get it done when I was there. But they moved, they had to leave the home and move into an outbuilding during the menstrual cycle.
Isn't that incredible?
Uh-huh. Because they were considered unclean. Mm-hmm.
That was before Tampax. Sure, well, that was one of the arguments against women being in the sanctuary in the Old Testament, you know, that they were unclean and had to be removed from the consecrated areas. And part of that was superstition, it was a lack of understanding, and it was, frankly, I think, mystifying to the dominant male ruling that this was something they couldn't do, that women could, and they didn't understand it, so they abolished it. If you can't explain it, why? You call it dirty. And that's been a lot of our problem with sex. We've not been able to deal with it very upfront in a very matter-of-fact, normal, human sort of way. It's been hidden. It's been whispered about. It's been done behind closed doors. It's part of our life that's extremely privatized. And there's a certain amount of that that I think should be preserved. I think there is an intimacy and a privacy and a trust level and so on between a male and female that is very sensitive and very beautiful, and that should be done, you know, instead of out here on the floor in front of the crowd. But on the other hand, it has, I think, given a connotation that has caused a lot of inhibition and fear and tragedy in male-female relationships. Yeah. Yeah? Did you have your hand up over here?
I did.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like you to speak to Paul's attitude possibly on marriage, where you could possibly do a better job in your single, in pursuing God's intention singly, but if you felt the marriage was a better attitude to pursue that, could you speak to that? Mm-hmm.
Well, Paul was an itinerant missionary. He was on the road. He had a lot of evangelical zeal. They thought very soon that Christ was coming back. I guess very much in the sense that we have heard some of those in this generation really feeling that we're in a nuclear age and we're going to be bombed. I think a young woman just said the other day, "I don't plan to have any children." I have a very real fear, not only for myself of going through a Hiroshima, but of having my children put through that kind of radiation sickness or horror. And I think in Paul's time, at the place and where the church was, and with his tremendous, overwhelming zeal to spread the gospel, it was not that he condemned marriage. It was he didn't think he had time for it, to do justice. It was urgent. Because any minute now, you see, Christ's coming back. This, you're going to hear the trumpet, and he's going to be here, and you can't waste time. It's not business as usual, you see, was what Paul was saying. Mm-hmm.
Last week we had a forum that gave us some information about what the cults are doing, and I was quite surprised to find that the spectrum is very wide on how cults handle sexuality. everything from these huge mass weddings, and then where they have to not be intimate with each other for months or years, and then only for procreation, to the children of God, which send out regular letters encouraging their followers to have fornication with everybody they can possibly get still long enough to do it with. And I think if part of the attraction of youth to either end of this is because of the way the church really doesn't affirm our sexuality, that those who have taken it so much to heart that they want to repress all physical nature of their being are maybe attracted to the one type of cult where it reinforces that. And then on the other hand, the ones that just are so overpowered by their internal feelings and hormones and everything that are just giving up on the hypocrisy of the system that they've grown up with and see, hey, it's free, it's okay. They say I can do what I want with my body. And then, of course, as you said, that even that is the casual kind of encounter and so forth, very destructive, and it doesn't get the person wholeness.
I think part of that is a result of the church coming on as big parent, and in some cases the younger generation rebels and they want to test out and try out through their own experience what that's all about, and then they come back. You know, they've had an abortion or they've been in the drug scene or something like that. And they come back and they look for some of these very rigid guidelines that will tell them how to live their life and take the responsibility from them for making these kinds of moral choices. We like to look to the church to make our moral decisions for us. Freedom is very frightening. To be responsible for your own decisions, to be accountable for your own behavior, is very hard. And so rather than risk change, a lot of times we hide behind legalism.
You're a campus pastor. Let's say a young fellow or girl who come to you for advice, and they were brought up that sex outside of marriage was wrong. Let's say they have a relationship, a commitment to a boy and a young girl, but they haven't had sexual intercourse, but they have strong feelings for each other, and they would come to you for advice. They'd say, we have the commitment, we would like to play together and share our physical relationship. But they want advice from you. What kind of advice from you would you give? And, of course, you were saying that you had to take, just like homosexuality, you had to take them where they are. And you may advise them that, you had to suffer the consequences, whatever it is. And let's say you took it all the way through and you know what might happen. Let's say they had a child and had to deal with their parents. And that they want advice. What kind of advice would you give them? Couldn't you give them advice?
Well, if it was a good day and I was in touch with myself, I wouldn't give them advice for anything. My tendency is to give advice, and that's bad news, I guess. There's a whole new pattern in relationships. A lot of young couples are, as we say, living together in relationship. And they feel quite comfortable with that. For a number of reasons. One, they've looked at their parents' marriage. It's been a disaster. The parents either have had a divorce or should have had a divorce, in their opinion. And so they're very cautious about commitment. I mean, whether you think this is good or whether you think this is bad, this seems to be the situation in growing numbers. Many of them see this as a postponement of covenant because they have other priorities at the moment. They're working on a doctorate, or they have other things that right now they want to give their full attention to, and they think that financially, to get into a legal contract is something they don't want to do right now. They can give you all kinds of reasons why, from their point of view, they are living in a moral relationship one with the other, that they don't think it's necessary for City Hall to give them a piece of paper or for the church to bless their union, because they know one another and have married themselves to each other, and they are living in a marriage relationship as far as they are concerned. And they aren't going to have any kids. And they have ways now that they don't have to have kids. They can plan that. So they see it. I'm not saying I agree with this. I'm saying this seems to be a growing situation. And not only with people in their 20s. There are a lot of older couples who, because of Social Security or because of certain financial arrangements or because one is divorced and has children that still need to get support from their own father, so they don't marry again. I mean, there are just so many circumstances here that play into these kinds of relationships and these kinds of...
I realize that, but see, the church has been given advice for how many years now on sexuality, trying to.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, young kids are looking for advice or some guidelines. Give that person, say, well, you're going to have to figure it out yourself whether you are committed enough or whether you have a good relationship. Here are all the consequences, and if you get pregnant, who's going to take care of the child, or you're going to give it back to mom and dad, kid. You go through all that, but they're looking for advice. It seems as though you have to, some way, all of a sudden we don't give advice anymore, we don't have guidelines. So I think
maybe what they're looking for is insight more than advice. I think probably people can come in and get advice, but they aren't going to take it unless they can own it, unless they appropriately have come to this sort of decision. I can say, you should do this, and in my opinion, this is the best thing to do. Better, I think, for them to have a person that they can sit down, the two of them, with and sort out and work through and test out the decision that they probably have already arrived at anyway. And if there is some sort of change in direction, it may very well come out of this rapport over a period of time. I don't think in 1 hour somebody can come in and make an appointment and I can give them advice and turn their life around for them. You know, I think that's not very realistic. I think we can sit down and reason together or look at the situation and try somehow on the basis of our faith to understand and be accountable for the decisions that we're in the midst of making.
Jean?
Yeah.
Can you see...
that people can be educated better about their marriage before they marry, so that there won't be so many mistakes made. You know, what's some of the rest do you think?
My immediate response to that is we just like you said, we learned from our parents. My mother's been divorced twice. And I learned more from my own family life than I ever learned from book learning or from whatever anyone else told me about it. So if we want to educate our children in what marriage means, we as the married couples communicate by the affection we show to each other and by the love we share and the joy and all that goes with the positive aspects of the marriage. That's where the children will really learn. Rather than saying, here are the criteria for a good marriage, I'll sit down and memorize them and live long and prosper or something like that.
But it's continues to repeat itself.
That's right, and that's an example of the sins of the father being generated, you know, being visited upon the children. Mm-hmm. We inherit from our parents, and we learn from them. And it's like my own example, the comment I wanted to interject earlier, is that I think underlying a lot of things is we really don't know what it is to love each other. And to have a full, mature love for another person. And Mary knows, the one who went to get our son Jason. She knows that I was afraid to tell her, I love you. Because as our relationship progressed, I really didn't know what love was at that time. And now we've been married now for 10 years this summer, and I'm still learning what it means to love and to share in a full and wholesome manner. And that's something we can't lay down in points list.
Sex is much more than genitalia or physical interaction. I mean, it's a context of relationship. You love one another sexually in many ways other than through genitalia.
I like to say something.
Yeah.
I represent these pregnant teenagers every day and mother. And I think what is so much needed, and that's in response to what you're saying, I think both of you are saying, is yes, they do need guidelines. Many don't get the ideas in the home, I agree with you. But if they don't get it, I think another place to get it is the church. And I see the difference. The girls that have, because the greatest pressure is from the peers to have sex and so forth, premarital. And no matter what the parents say, and they can come from the best homes, they need what the peers say is more important at a certain time than what the parents say. So if you don't have a peer group that supports you in the Christian teaching, then they are prone to listen to what the others say. And I think they need support. And I see the difference, the ones that have a Christian community, youth groups, I mean, in specific, where they can talk about these things, where they can support each other, they do much better. And if somebody fails, it happens too, then they are still accepted with love. Yes, and tremendous insight. I was amazed, a 15-year-old who became pregnant, and she knew her Christian community didn't approve of it, but because of the acceptance, she gained so much insight that she is from there on changing, and it wouldn't have happened without the support. So what I'm saying is, what I regret that I don't see more is good Christian youth groups that help support the teenagers to live the way we ought to as Christians.
You recognize the power that the popular musicians, singers have on influencing our young people. And I would just like to see some kind of influence that would come from the religious groups, like she was talking about, that would be just as powerful.
Yeah.
I wonder how many marriages of say a generation ago were just finished out because of the compulsion, you know, that, well, even though it's bad, I've got to put up with this, and probably came out of the generation of those that didn't allow dancing among young people, that if there was such complete repression by the church that it included going so far as living in a really unwholesome relationship for 50 years and celebrating a 50th anniversary and never really having experienced good, healthy, sexual, emotional relationship. That there's just sort of, you know, a condemnation almost, you know, that you just, well, you got married to the guy, you have to stick by him no matter what, even if he beats you. And I think the church may have been responsible for keeping people in relationships that were very healthy because they were raised with such strict ideas of, you know, the body is nothing. We repress it completely. Maybe we swung too far in not giving guidance, but I would rather have a lack of guidance rather than one that is so repressive that it continues those really sad types.
Well, if we're talking about the feast of life, surely we ought to rediscover our bodies as part of that feast. And surely sexual interaction is part of that celebration, part of that joy. And I think we as Christians should reclaim that with much more gusto.
Lady sitting next to me was saying maybe the Christian community could take a bigger stance on this, and the scripture that came to mind that I've thought about, and when I get it, and I sometimes I'll get it just a glimpse of just what it means, and it really exciting, but it says it has a lot to do with what we're talking about, I think, and it says Jesus was speaking to somebody. He says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things," and I'll put in the parentheses, "that you seek after," which would be including what we're talking about here, "shall be added unto you." And like I, this minister at a church that I go to, I say, "Tony, you and your wife are real happy. I mean, you look like you got a real fantastic marriage. How did you do it?" And he goes, "Well," he goes, "first off, Mark, we weren't looking to get on our own strength, we weren't looking to get married, but first off, we were both totally in love with the Lord, and we were doing what he wanted, and then seeing us out, our first love was for the Lord. He gave us our one of these other necessities that we have in our life, and he brought us together, but it was totally the Lord that we were brought together, and that is why our relationship is so good, is because our first priority is for the Lord, and then it's for each other. We have our priorities set straight." Mm-hmm. And that I can see the words that he said, I can see the application of that in their lives. It wasn't just idle words coming out of his mouth, he was living what he was saying, and that made him, I haven't grasped it the way he's grasped it, because he's, but it made a pretty good impact on me when he shared that with me. Mm-hmm.
Well, what time is it?
48.
Probably about time to say. I mean, this is a topic that is inexhaustible. It's something I hope you'll continue to talk about now, even though we break up over lunch and this afternoon and with your spouses and your kids and wherever.
One of the quotes you gave us was from Paul in Ephesians 5.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the verse before that indicates that husbands and wives are to serve each other, be subject to one another.
Mm-hmm.
As unto the Lord. And I think that verse and that thought is forgotten or neglected as over against the succeeding one, which whoever you quoted wants to emphasize that thought of women being subject to the husband as unto the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And both are to be subject to each other.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
when you think about
it, learn that.
Yeah. When you think about it, that is the full component of the human condition, male and female, created in juxtaposition as the whole human.
Single people have no sexuality.
Single people have no sexuality? Oh, no, not at all.
But I mean, I sit here and listen to these conversations, and I'm suddenly feeling like I need to get out there on a branch and hang up.
No. Because that's part of what I was trying to emphasize, that sexuality is more than male-female intercourse or genitalia. You are a woman. You are a sensual, sexual being by virtue of how you are created.
You started out very well with that, but I'm listening to this
contemporary discussion that's going on around me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, I think that I'm really glad you raised that point, because our sexuality is not fully defined just simply in terms of male-female coitus. You know, whether I am married or whether I am single, whether I'm a widow, I mean, I am a woman. I am a woman and created to be such. And I'm a sensual woman. And I'm alive. And there are many ways that my feminine nature expresses itself, and that I can move in this world as a sexual being. You know, and I certainly didn't mean to say because you're single that you're...
I'm not coming at you. I said you started that out very well.
Yeah,
I listened to the conversation around me, and I think that it gets to be forgotten,
mm-hmm.
whether I'm a female or a male,
mm-hmm.
I've chosen this lifestyle.
Right. That's a very good point. Yeah.
And I think the church needs to be constantly made aware of that. It isn't only the young people who need that kind of guidance.
Mm-hmm. But the mature people do. The older people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one person cannot satisfy another person's total sexual need. This is another reason I think marriages fall apart so badly. Because there are many sexual ways that we relate with one another. You may have one mate, but you are in relationship with the whole human family. And there are a lot of ways that males and females interact in a supportive, stroking, complimentary, full way that enhances and makes you even more interesting. And when you get very possessive and very narrow in your understanding of your sexuality, it isn't possible. You know, we use the pyramid example. It used to be that you had family, extended family, that were a support base. And when a couple married, they had the base of the pyramid was the wider community and the familial relationship. Seems that in our day and age, that has inverted. And now, the single couple, male and female, are called upon to bear all of the stress of a total societal pressure. And we look male to female or husband to wife in young marriages that no longer have that. They've had a lot of mobility, a lot of rootlessness, a lot of anonymity, and for them, just one-on-one to bear the full weight of relationship is not realistic, and they're falling apart because they have not developed a wider community of interaction. They have not looked outside of just themselves in this kind of self-preoccupied, all that matters is our love for one another kind of romantic image. And they collapse because they simply can't bear the weight of all that.